Session number 11486, rule 4.
We've already engaged fighting Russia, that enormous country, and obviously it wasn't prospering. It was an incredible campaign to imagine you can occupy Russia, that enormous country. So then declaring war on a country like America with its potential seemed beyond belief.
It's very interesting, your attitude, you know, towards the Allies, the Italians and Japanese. It seems that there was nothing quite like the so-called Big Three in this country, you know, where the Americans, it was Roosevelt, Stalin and Churchill, were always presented as a very united bunch. What was that attempted in the propaganda? Did they try to get that sort of
image?
Yes,
I think they did. And Mussolini was made out to be a friend of Hitler's, and we saw pictures of his son-in-law, who again was extremely good-looking, Count Ciano, and we all thought he was rather a heartthrob. But you didn't take them for full. I mean, the jokes going round in an Italian tank being built with only reverse gears, you know, this sort of thing. I suppose it's Germans saying it. It's a pretty disciplined, organized country, and it's a being racist to say this against the Italians, of course. But this was the general feeling, and the Japanese were too remote in those days, where ordinary people never flew or traveled that far. It was just a remote eastern country one had no relationship to.
I'd like to ask you a little more about the war service that you mentioned, you know, this farm work mm-hmm. that you did. Would that have been compulsory?
Yes, it was in 1942, and being at a gymnasium, we were all expected to do 3 months' service for the nation, as it were. And it was August, September, October. We had to do it, so part of our holiday and part of our term time. And we were allocated to farms in northern Germany. I arrived a little late because we were still having a family holiday. I think this was disapproved of, but however, I did. And I got, I think, the worst place on a little island in the North Sea, which still exists, where I worked on a farm where there were 11 children and the oldest was 14. There was no water, no gas and no electricity. We got the water out of a water hole. It was incredibly primitive. I'd slept up on in the roof space next to the corn where there were masses of rats. They didn't come in the room, so it wasn't that bad. The sanitary conditions were absolutely frightful. You went through the cow byre and went onto a loo there, and it was absolutely frightful. It's no light. I had to get up, I suppose, up at 5, 6 o'clock. Well, that didn't worry me much. I had to do housework, and I had to help make the fire and do some cleaning, whichever there was to do. There were two Russian prisoners of war who ate exactly the same stuff as we did. They were very good-tempered and very friendly. I think they might well have wanted to stay on in Germany. I remember one just once, for the joy of life, poured a whole bucket of water over me just because he felt in that sort of mood. They ate, and for one session, I remember making dumplings, and they, between the two of them, had 40 dumplings, which they all ate up.
4-0.
And that was all quite friendly. It was... I hated it there because it was so primitive. And in fact, I ended up having jaundice, and the family got, I believe, it's typhus, something you get from water, rather than typhoid, isn't it? You get from water, from bad water. But that was just about happening as I was about to leave. There was a French prisoner of war, whom I talked to quite a lot in French because he was the only educated person there. Small children couldn't even understand my high German, and I couldn't understand them. It quite shook me, actually. They only learned high German at school. It was that sort of primitive community. I worked very hard. I found their eating habit absolutely awful, and I complained bitterly on returning that I'd been sent there and gave a very graphic description of the German farms, and they had always been shown as, you know, the man working the land and how wonderful it all was. It most certainly wasn't. I had no further contact with them once I left. I got paid the minimum. I worked very hard, and I was delighted when I could go home again, but one did one stint, and that was it, and we all had to do it. I think the people who weren't medically fit had to work in some social security type office in the meantime. My sister had to do that. And that was the war service. It wasn't much. It was just. It showed me actually to cope with really disgusting set of circumstances. For instance, they made soup, and which was put on one side, a sort of cold soup, and it came on the table and there was a mouse in it, which was just lifted out and thrown away, and that was the end of it. So I felt anything afterwards I could really cope with quite well.
Can you remember a sort of turning point of the war when, you know, morale changed in Germany? You've explained, you know, the sort of depression of the Russian invasion and then when Germany declared war on America.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I was wondering something like Stalingrad.
Oh, yes. When the Russian war started, I don't think it's right to say there was a depression. There was perhaps some apprehension, but everything had gone so well, militarily speaking, that people worried a bit, but they thought, well, perhaps it'll be all right. Yes, I suppose the turning point came with the first winter in Russia, for which the army was unprepared, and the losses. And then, of course, yes, with Stalingrad, where there were a lot of local boys were in Stalingrad, in that particular army. The army that had, or parts of the people who had been billeted on us, they were all at Stalingrad. So one knew that, and one knew the a lot of families who had people there. And that made a very profound impression. One followed that too, and that was in fact broadcast. First of all, as the brave army, and it was brought like that, and the general Paulus was lauded and made to be a hero until he surrendered against the orders. I think they more or less stood to the last man, but perhaps not quite to the very last. Yes, one saw reports, and it was broadcast sort of day by day. One heard it in the paper, and I think that shook everybody very much. It was a pretty dreadful thing. I've subsequently, of course, read books on it and seen things about it. It was awful, quite awful.
You mentioned the books you've read subsequently. Would you say it was reported quite honestly at the time, that you were made aware of, you know, the great defeat that it was and the hardship of the troops?
Yes, I think we were made aware of the hardship of the troops, but it was probably put more into heroic light. And the defeat wasn't at the time made out to be as bad as it was. I think that it really was the big turning point. I don't think that was officially stated, but one felt it might well be, particularly if one looked at the map. What was emphasised, I think, were the Russian losses, which, of course, were also quite terrific. So it was said, well, they have lost a lot of people, so they're weakened, as it were. Yes, and then the losses came through. Of course, people from the Eastern Front were never reported, well, they were reported killed or missing, as the Russians didn't belong to the Red Cross. You never knew who was a prisoner of war or not. If you weren't killed and seen to have been killed and known to have been killed, you were simply reported missing. So you didn't know. So people hoped for years and years, of course, that their son would be, well, a prisoner and survive being a prisoner, as it were. And then, yes, I suppose that was Stalingrad. I remember going to a concert then. Just we used to go to concerts quite regularly and seeing mothers there crying. People who'd lost two sons. Which at the time was, well, at any time is quite distressing. But it sort of, the air raids became so bad at that stage that I suppose one forgot about the details of what was happening at the front, because one was really rather concerned with one's own survival and hardship. Because one was sort of, in a sense, one considered oneself frontline as well. So I think what subsequently happened, one always saw through one's own vision of what's it going to be like tomorrow or tonight. Our house, just in 43, our house was very badly bombed. And we were then still in our cellar of our house, and it sort of, oh, it was quite an extraordinary thing. We were in the cellar. My father was there that night, and our neighbours were in, with a very small child, were in our cellar as well. And one always knew what would happen, because it was quite an efficient service through the radio. As soon as enemy aircraft, as of course they were called, flew in over Holland, all the radio program was interrupted, and the news were given how they were flying in, and you became very much aware. You knew if they go to a certain point and turn east, that would be someone else, and if they were then going southwest, that might be you. So one followed it in great detail, and you knew really within sort of 10 minutes or not whether they would be over you or whether they would be coming. My father also always had rather detailed information from, because he was in charge of air raid protection. I think he had it direct from some army place. So we knew. So we had a very heavy air raid, and we knew it would come. And first we had some incendiaries, and there was one outside the house, so we put our steel helmets on, which we'd acquired somehow, and put that fire out, because it was a bad idea to have a fire when an air raid's coming, because obviously it can be seen from above. And we were just back in the cellar. My father and I went out. We were just back in the cellar when we had a very landmine just there. And it's quite an incredible thing. You could almost feel each part of the house being affected. And the roof obviously was blown off again, and some walls came down, and it was a house where we were in the cellar, and there were another two stories plus the loft. And you could feel the shaking going right through the house, and you sort of sat there and thought, Lord, I hope it's going to hold. And then that stopped, and you were still there, and you thought, Lord, this was close by, we will have to investigate. Well, of course you can't immediately, you have to wait until the air raid is over. But I remember that very distinctly, the amount of time one thought that went by. It must have been all absolute part of a second. But it seemed quite long at the time, which I always thought was fascinating. When we eventually got upstairs, I always tell this tale, we'd been drinking some wine on a table like this, and the tablecloth was whipped away and the wine glasses were standing on the table. I would never believe it if anybody else told me this, but it was actually like that, or everything was in total chaos, but I don't know, three or so of the wine glasses were standing on the bare table with the tablecloth whipped away underneath. So that was the house being very severely damaged. We then couldn't live in it, and we were farmed out to friends, and sort of my parents, I suppose, slept in the cellar, I think, from then on for a time. It was, in fact, even though it was 1943, it was repaired. And we eventually moved back in again.
Would the state have done that for people, you know, who were bombed? Would the sort of government have paid?
No, it was a works house. It was belonged to the works, and they did this for their employees, or whom they wanted to do it for. And it was pretty fantastic the way they always repaired it. I don't know how many new roofs we had, because they were always blown off, and how many sets of windows, which in the end, of course, we didn't get proper windows anymore. But I don't know whether the state would have done it. I doubt it, actually. It was a question of knowing who would do it and getting materials. That would all get different. That's all becoming more difficult. But if you have a big industrial organization, of course, they always make it possible, and they did make it possible. So our house eventually was repaired. My father, I suppose, had some clout, and it happened. That was that. Yes, it was frightening, but I think when one is young, one gets over these things, and there's a certain amount, dreadful to say, of excitement in that sort of thing. Quite an amazing, really. You are genuinely frightened at the time, but nonetheless you get over it, and then it's something to talk about. I remember there was a tiny child. Our neighbours had somebody living there, and it was a tiny child in the area shelter, and that child absolutely just slept through it, of course, didn't notice anything, was a couple of months old or something. And one sort of saw that and thought, golly, nothing can happen to something so lovely and innocent. But it did. Yes, and the first news, too, of friends who died in air raids, a school friend of mine an aeroplane was shot down and landed on her house, and they died. That sort of thing, of course, occurred. But this, yes, this was in 1943.
And was the pattern of bombing different now?
Yes, it gradually became different. In the early days of the war, there seemed to be always something that was being aimed at, like the autobahn or railings or a station or industrial installations. And although, of course, they weren't always hit, and population was hit as well, but that seemed to be the intention, particularly with the English bombing, which of course the beginning was all English, tended to be more precision bombing. Later on, it was a question, it seemed to be a question of throwing a lot of bombs onto the towns, and where we called it terrorize the population, making them afraid, making them feel this is what war is like, particularly when the incendiary raid started, where everything burnt and was so destroyed, we said, and depending on the town, of course, they were absolutely dreadful because people couldn't escape. And then you had the combination of incendiaries being thrown first and then the explosive bombs into that, because it was all alight, as it were, and very visible. So that changed gradually. I suppose one always thought of that as the change when once America came into the war. Whether that's true or not, I don't know.
Did it have the desired effect? You know, do you think morale was depressed because of it?
I don't know. I think it also set up a certain amount of, well, resentment and hatred. When all the churches were bombed, it seemed a dreadful thing to do. It did wear the population down, and of course it made great difficulty for communications. It's amazing always to me how quickly communications were set up again, railway lines, amazing speed, and how people coped in the industrial plants and got them working again. It seemed very swift and really incredibly efficient how that was done, and how production must have been affected, but I think it was not as much affected as was thought or was hoped for at the time on the other side. It was always all put together again, and everybody had to work that much longer, and it was put right or made workable again.
And how about the attitude? You know, you explained earlier that the bombing you thought was British, mm-hmm. or a lot of it. You know, did your attitude change towards the British, do you think? You know, was there any sort of hatred, feelings of... You explain resentment, but, you know, what was it stronger than that?
Some people, it must have been. My mother happened to be very pro-British because she'd been in England before World War I, so she was a great friend of England. I can't think, personally speaking, that the attitude changed. I can only remember thinking, "Ooh, I hope they shoot you down." But that was a transitory thing. You didn't want to be bombed. You said, well, I hope they shoot them down. But that wasn't in any way real hatred. One watched people being, did see people being shot down. And as much as you didn't want them to bomb you, when you saw them come down, it was also that ghastly feeling. There's some young man in there who is a father of someone or the brother of someone. I can't think that the hatred amongst the people increased in any way, not really.
How about the propaganda? You know, did that become very strident at this stage?
Yes, it became strident, but a little bit perhaps impotent. The emphasis on we must see this through rather than the glory of it all, that I think changed rather, and very much these warmongers, you know, this is obviously, as the other side was accused of presenting us with this, and we will all stand together and fight together and see it through together. That was the tenor, I think, later on. Because there wasn't much glory left, so they had to, I suppose, find a different way of presenting the news.
Well, were you also exhorted to sacrifice? You know, were you asked to give up anything, like your saucepans to make planes, this sort of thing?
We had very strict collections of things at school. All newspapers had to be taken in, and bones had to be taken in, and silver paper had to be taken in, and you got awarded points per class, per form, for handing in X number of pounds. It was all registered. You took it in, and the amount of grams were registered. And, of course, there was less and less paper about. You never had things wrapped anymore, and the newspaper was very thin. But my father had a mass of technical books which he'd stored somewhere, which we took, had a ration and took so much per week so that we had something to bring. That wasn't a sacrifice. There was a collection of furs for the soldiers in winter. No. I can't remember anything else, no gold or silver or anything like that, that I can recall.
And how about the rationing situation? You explained how earlier on, you know, there was a shortage of bread, which the Ukraine grain helped out in 41.
Well, I can't remember being really short of food. It was rationed, one coped, but one wasn't really hungry. The luxuries of life had gone. But one had a certain ration of fat and meat, and we had a lot out of our garden. I suppose quite a few people started keeping hens and that sort of thing, but we most certainly weren't hungry. And whether there was a difference in rationing between the heavily bombed town and the eastern areas that were not bombed, I don't know. It seems quite possible. We most certainly had extra rations here and there. But it wasn't really a problem. My mother coped quite well.